U.S. factory activity slowed.
Based on hitting a shareholder value as market capitalization.
A lot more global. So creating more programming not only for, you know, us here in the English-speaking U.S.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
That music means it's Friday afternoon. Welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Steve Bertrand here. I have been away for a few days because of baseball and other things, so certainly nice to be back with you on the Wintrust Business Lunch. A little later in the program, August is Child Welfare Month, I think it's called. But anyway, WalletHub.com did a study to sort of look at which states are best and which are worst when it comes to taking care of kids, whether it's kids who are abused or education levels and things like that. Illinois, I think, came in 33rd, so middle of the pack. But Indiana was among the worst, number 9 in the top 10 of states that are bad, actually, for kids. We will talk to Jill Gonzalez about that and what might be done about it a little bit later in the program. Also, we will look into the raids in Mississippi at the meat factories and elsewhere. It impacts a Northwest Chicago company, and Claire Bushy from Crane Chicago Business writes about that. So that's later in the program. We'll talk about the money being lost by business because of these ICE raids. But let's start by saying hello to Andrea Haines from the Chicago Tribune. Andrea, welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
Thanks, Steve. Great to be here.
Hey, one of the stories I was reading in the Trib this week, and I feel like I've read different versions of this in the past. This one feels a little more legitimate, but are they finally going to dress up Union Station?
Yes, in particular, there are plans announced this week to open a food hall in a part of Union Station that has been vacant for 40 years.
Now, I don't commute via the train like I used to, but I used to be in and out of Union Station every day. I would walk through the Great Hall. Sometimes I would walk up the ramp to Clinton, but I never noticed this curtained-off area that was the subject of a fatal fire 40 years ago. It sounds a little like Miss Havisham in Great Expectations. They just sealed this place off?
Definitely, yeah. I also don't commute through there, so I have also not seen it. But, this whole area has basically been just blocked off since this fire a long, long time ago. And now with the, food halls, which, as we've discussed, are much more upscale than food courts, are becoming a big thing. And so there's a plan now to turn that area into a pretty fancy multi-level food hall.
And, well, there's the French Market at Ogilvie Station or Northwestern Station. Is it something similar to that, or what are we going to see there?
Yeah, it's unclear yet. I think they're waiting to see who comes forward and wants to be in the location. But I think the idea is definitely to have something more along the lines of a French Market versus just, fast food and that type of thing.
Yeah, they do have some franchise stores at Union Station, which are relatively new, well, 10 or 15 years maybe. But it's sort of in a crowded hodgepodge den of sort of hallways and things. It's not that comfortable. So I would love to see them sort of dress it up. This comes maybe not so much, well, certainly because of Metro passengers, but also because of what's happening around Union Station these days, right?
Definitely. I think this whole idea that, the West Loop is right there, everything is getting nicer, fancier, there's more jobs there, there's more people headed west. It's all definitely kind of centering around that idea.
One of these areas where I used to huddle and wait for my bus was right on the corner where the BMO Harris Tower is going up. So that's going to bring a lot more workers to the area, too.
Definitely.
All right, so we'll wait for this one. So they just put out, they haven't really even put out bids, right? They've just asked for ideas. So are we a ways away from seeing what's going to happen here?
Yes, there will not be anything opening for quite a while, and just what they're looking for so far is, again, just to see who comes forward, what shops, what restaurants, like who's interested in possibly setting up shop there.
All right, great opportunity maybe if someone's got some ideas. So Union Station is expanding. Walgreens is contracting a little bit. Walgreens announced this week it's going to close about 200 stores, and it's a smaller part of a much bigger picture, right? Pharmacies are kind of under attack.
They are. Like a lot of businesses, they're kind of getting chipped away at in every direction. There are things that are going on with pharmacy that impact them, and there are things like Ulta, which is selling drugstore-type makeup, and that's cutting into their business there. So both Walgreens and CVS are trying to kind of get to the right number of stores and get to the right kind of services, and really they're both looking at a blend of new types of services.
So the idea, where do they make their money? Is it from prescription? I guess my question is, do they want me to come to the store to get my prescriptions and then buy other stuff, or do they want me to come to the store to buy other stuff while I'm filling out my prescriptions?
Yeah, I think they want all that business, but Amazon, others are cutting into some of that, like the, you know, the grab a gallon of milk or the buy a bottle of shampoo kind of situation. And, you know, a lot of their pharmacy plans that kind of push you into mail order prescriptions.
Right.
So then you're obviously not entering the store.
You know,
so what CVS and Walgreens, you know, they're looking at other ways to expand the health offerings within the store where you might come to get more health services, and that would actually physically bring you in.
I chuckled a little bit. I mean, it's not funny, but I think it was CVS. They're putting in some medical more specialization, as you said, in medical services and things like that. And one was more CPAP, cleaning machines or things CPAP related. It seems to me like we are on a curve toward everyone eventually having a CPAP, and we're going to all end up at our CVS with them, apparently.
Yeah, it does. It does make me think of sort of, you know, the baby boomers. They're getting up there. There's going to be a lot of services, I'm sure, that are targeted toward, you know, getting that population in for a variety of health needs.
Yeah.
And it definitely does mention sleep apnea, nutritional counseling, and other things that people would show up for.
So, you know, and they've had this movement toward the Minute Clinics and things like that. That's all part of it. I get my prescriptions at Walgreens, and I will get push notifications from them when I have a prescription that I might not use every day or all the time or whatever, you know, might be coming due for renewal. They'll send me a text saying, hey, come buy more drugs from us.
They can all be pretty aggressive. The stores and the suppliers. I had a case where I had to take a pill literally one time,
mm-hmm.
but it's a type of pill that sometimes people take for quite a while, and they were so aggressive in trying to chase me down. I was kind of like, please, I literally don't need any more of it. Kind of getting people to regularly take their medication is obviously a good thing in a lot of ways, but it's also a marketing opportunity. They want to make absolutely sure that if you are supposed to be taking something, you continue to take it.
Yeah, I was going to make a pusher man joke, but you're right. One of the big problems we have healthcare-wise is that a lot of people who are on prescription drugs don't take them, so that's a plus. Okay, one more. I did not know that VIA was actually a rideshare company in Chicago. I guess they've been here a few years, but they've just expanded their territory and they're hoping to step things up.
Yeah, VIA is small and it's definitely under the radar as compared to Uber and Lyft, which of course are the other two rideshare companies. And they had a narrower area, but they have now expanded as of this week to cover the entire city. And they're also offering rides for $2.50 if they connect to transit stops. So they're really trying to raise their profile and their service.
And they're making the argument that they are benefiting CTA and Metra, things like that. They're the last mile or the first mile, whereas the CTA and Metra are saying that Lyft and Uber have really been taking away from ridership.
Yeah, I think the rides probably do just take away. I don't know, honestly, how much this will impact. I guess we'll know later when we see numbers on that. They do say they want to be a feeder system. But even if it's a little more than $2.50, it can be nice to have a complete ride. And what they do is a little bit more like a bus in that they might not come to your exact location. They might have a pickup spot for a few people that's a block or two from where you are. So it almost combines that idea of meeting the transit, but then you're also getting a much more private ride,
Andrea,
in a car versus a bus.
Andrea Haines, thank you for joining us. Have a great weekend.
You too. Thanks, Steve.
You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN. You know, the U.S. has the seventh highest child poverty rate among economically developed countries in the world. The seventh. This is Child Support Awareness Month, and Wallet Hub has sort of been looking at the numbers, analyzing state by state to see where we do well by kids and where we do not so well. Analyst Jill Gonzalez is on a phone line to talk about that. Jill, welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
Thanks for having me back.
I guess I was surprised a little bit. After I thought of it, it made more sense. But I was surprised to see that when you look at the top 10, they are almost all rural states. We think of inner cities as places of poverty and kids in trouble, but it's really out in the country where the kids are having difficulty.
Yeah, when we look at the top 10 here, not necessarily top, I mean, this is not a list where you want to be closer to number one, but places like West Virginia, Oklahoma, Indiana, all here in the top. And it's been really interesting to hear what different states have to say about this. I mean, this study is about underprivileged children, but it really indirectly has to do with another huge epidemic that's happening across the country, which is opioids.
Really?
Indiana is a very good example of this. Unfortunately, parents who are overdosing or who are having to go to rehab because of opioids leave a lot of children in foster care, where Indiana has the fourth highest amount right now, leaves a lot of single-parent families or families with grandparents and no present parents. So that's actually a huge indirect effect here.
Indiana comes in number 9 on the list. Just quickly, District of Columbia is number 1, which is the urban area I'm talking about, but then it pretty much goes country. New Mexico, West Virginia, Mississippi, Louisiana, Alaska, Oklahoma, Alabama, then Indiana at 9, and then finally Nevada. I also was struck by the number of maltreated children. Kentucky was number 1 there, but Indiana, number 2. What are we talking about when we're talking about maltreated children?
Maltreatment has to do with abuse and neglect, things like food insecurity. So all of these things. And again, we are seeing spikes across the country where this opioid addiction is present.
So this is an opioid situation we're talking about by and large.
I would say it's certainly one of the biggest factors here, just when we're looking at how many children are being left to fend for themselves or to go into foster care or suffering from maltreatment.
And where is Illinois? I mean, I don't know that we should be proud. I think it's 31, 32. I don't know if that's a number to hang your hat on, but we're not leading the country anyway.
Right. It's 33 overall. It does better when it comes to education scores, so that's obviously a good thing, especially if a child does not have the ideal home life. We hope that they can get some rescue from that, from their school life.
And what else can you see in Illinois? I mean, how are we when it comes to maltreated children and things like that?
Illinois could do a little bit better when it comes to maltreatment. Health, in terms of this underprivileged children report, is where it did the worst. It ranks 25th overall.
Really?
So right at average. And a lot of that goes back to maltreatment, to food insecurity rates, to even uninsured children. That number could be a little bit higher, too. I mean, Illinois, you see good numbers when it comes to most of the cities or bigger suburbs, but it gets rural as well, and that's where we see these uninsured spikes.
And so, you know, I don't want to beat a dead horse here, but because we've talked about the opioid situation, but I mean, there must be something more to it as well. The rural areas don't, the education isn't there, the food access. It's striking to me that, you know, we think of the inner city as the place where we have our problems in this country, and it's really not. It's in the farmlands.
Exactly, yeah. Education suffers when you get into more rural areas, a lot of teacher shortages, a lot of doctor shortages as well. In some states, we see big insurers pulling out of either statewide insurance programs, where some counties, rural counties, either have no options in terms of where they can get insured, or maybe one that's very expensive. So that certainly does. Healthcare and education also play a huge role here.
And this is a business show, obviously, so there's not money in it for these insurance companies or these hospitals. It's becoming more and more depressed. If you're in that area, it's hard for you to probably find a job in some cases or keep a job and keep your kids in school and take care of them. And what states are doing well, and what can we learn from them and apply that maybe to these other states?
The states that are doing the best tend to be Northeastern, New Jersey, the best overall, New Hampshire, Connecticut, Maryland, Massachusetts, all doing very well here. All have great education programs, right? Really good foundations, not only K-12 public, but when you get into universities as well. I think having those top universities nearby certainly does motivate parents, teachers, students to really do well, to stay in school. And great healthcare systems. Massachusetts has the highest insured rate in the country. I think their uninsured rate is about 2%. So that's another thing that really helps here.
Jill Gonzalez, an analyst at Wallet Hub. Thanks very much for joining us today, Jill. I appreciate it.
Anytime.
You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN, sponsored by Wintrust Chicago's Bank. All right, today 35.7 million Americans live alone. That's 28% of all U.S. households, up from 13% in 1960, 23% in 1980. I know that because Ellen Byron of the Wall Street Journal has been writing about it, and she joins us on a phone line now. Ellen, welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So fascinating to me that, I mean, I guess it's not that surprising that more and more of us are living alone. What's interesting to me is how consumer product companies are trying to keep up. I mean, is this something that is just starting to register with them?
Yeah, it is, surprisingly, because this trend of more people living alone has been going on for some years, but we're seeing more and more product makers waking up to this fact. When I found out that almost one-third of American households are single-person households, I knew that that was a number that begged a story. And so I started calling companies asking if they knew about the statistic. And if so, what were they doing about it? And then, in fact, there are lots of rather low-profile ways that they are trying to accommodate these households.
I'm wondering what they said to you when you asked them if they knew of it, because surely some did, but it seems that others might have been surprised by the numbers.
Right. So most of the companies that I spoke with knew all about the census data that I was looking at, and what they were in the middle of doing is figuring out how to best go after this audience. And one of the bigger impacts that this trend has had is on the kitchen appliance industry and laundry machine makers, because for generations, those products have been marketed towards families. So
right.
It's all about how many towels can you stuff into your washing machine? How big of a turkey can you cook in your oven? And more people don't need that at all. And so making smaller machines requires considerable capital investment and engineering to redesign machines to work in a smaller footprint. And that's happening. It's happening with luxury appliance makers at the very high end. I spoke with Jennaire, which is a brand owned by Whirlpool. I also spoke with more mainstream appliance makers like Haier, which bought GE Appliances. And they are very focused on accommodating smaller metro areas, people who live in apartments and don't necessarily
right.
need to haul in a whole supply of pool towels.
Well, that's what I was going to say. So it wouldn't hurt to have a bigger stove, I guess, unless you're trying to live in a smaller space. And that's what we're talking about in these instances.
Mm-hmm. And people are looking at the waste of energy, for example. I mean, they don't necessarily need a giant 48-inch range if they're only cooking for themselves and paying their own utility bills.
It strikes me that one of the problems is, you know, if you're single living alone and you buy a loaf of bread, you're probably going to throw some of that bread away. So it's, you know, it's wasteful in that way. You might want to save money by buying a smaller loaf of bread. Well, that's not always the case. Some of these singles, whether they're millennials living in cities or older Americans living alone, are willing to spend up in order to sort of buy down.
Yes, Americans absolutely hate throwing away food that they haven't gotten a chance to eat.
That explains our waistbands.
That is a highly emotional issue across all income ranges. They hate not being able to use up food that they buy. And I spoke with one young woman who realized that she can't buy heads of romaine lettuce in her grocery store
right.
because it's only sold in packs of three. And no matter how hard she tries, she can't get through three heads of romaine lettuce in a week before it goes off. And so she has started paying up. She buys salad mixed bags of lettuce in order to have salads and eat well. But she knows full well that she's paying more per bite than she would be if she only bought the heads of lettuce.
You know, I have to tell you, Ellen.
She told me she stopped buying loaves of bread.
It's occurred to me. Now, I live predominantly, I have one student still in school, but he's gone most of the year, so it's my wife and myself. And I always resisted buying those chopped vegetables. It just seemed like such a waste of money for me until I started looking at it myself, and I totally get the romaine lettuce thing. We were throwing away so much when we were buying whole pieces of fruit or vegetables.
Mm-hmm. And so people would rather pay more per bite and not throw anything away than perhaps pay a little less but have to throw it all, unused portions away. And food companies certainly are aware of this.
They're willing to pay significantly more. I want you to tell me about Betty Crocker and their mug treats. But first I'll say a mug treat per serving is $2.99, 75 cents a serving, I should say, which compares to 15 cents a serving if you were to make an entire cake. How is it that mug treats came to be?
Well, Betty Crocker researchers realized that people grew up with the Betty Crocker brand and liked those cakes, but when you live alone, you're not making a 9x13 cake for yourself. You might have, perhaps, when you had a family or when you were young and your mom or dad made you the cake, but when you're alone, you're often not even walking down the baking aisle anymore. And so rather than give up those sales to the deli aisle where you can buy individual slices of cake when you want to, they decided to create this line of mug treats, which basically is a single serving cake mix. You pour the mix into a mug, add some water, make it in the microwave, and then add frosting. And they've found that people still want that indulgence of a slice of cake, but they don't want to make the whole thing. And again, people will pay more per bite for that.
It sounds like they could almost make an entire cake for what they're paying for four servings of these mug treats. But like you said, no one wants to throw things away. Okay, in the end, it always comes down to toilet paper, doesn't it?
It does. Now, this is one of the more unexpected twists to the story. So I had talked to lots of product makers who told me smaller, 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 individually packaged items. Procter & Gamble found that people who live alone actually want a bigger roll of toilet paper. So they sent researchers into urban areas where apartments are significantly smaller than the suburban homes they've long served, and found that people will almost always carry extra inventory of toilet paper in their home. That is a product you do not want to run out of. However, storing that is complicated for these consumers. They stuff them under beds, in kitchen cupboards, and basically anywhere else they can find a place to stash a roll of toilet paper. And so Charmin, which is owned by Procter & Gamble, invented something called the Forever Roll.
And it nearly
and
is
it
forever.
It is a giant roll of toilet paper. And basically, you carry your entire roll, or your entire household inventory of toilet paper on one roll. And Charmin throws in a new toilet roll holder for free when you order this online. It's still in the test phase, but you can order it through Charmin.com. And it's doing especially well with people who live alone.
I love the fact that Charmin also did the research to find it so that it would fit precisely between the toilet and the wall, the typical space there. They said that's a space that no matter how small the apartment is usually not used, and so we'll exploit that. So that's bigger, but it's also interesting to me that these people who live alone, you know, they don't have to please a partner or they don't have to answer to a partner, so they tend to indulge when it comes to things like closets or dressing spaces, things like that.
Yes. They will splurge on a custom closet, possibly even turning a den into one. I spoke with one woman who has been slowly renovating her house to suit her specifically, and she built a luxury dressing room full of custom closets and a chandelier and a fancy rug. And that's where she gets dressed in the morning and enjoys it. And when I spoke with the closet designer, she said that a growing percentage of her business is catering indeed to these single people, and they are more likely to splurge on the extras because they're only pleasing themselves.
More and more of us are living alone. Ellen Byron writes about that in the Wall Street Journal. Ellen, I enjoyed the article, and thanks very much for joining us today.
Great speaking with you. Thanks.
It's the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN.
Start the timer, because here's the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing and examining Chicago business news of the day. Sports marketing these days goes to new lengths, and when you have the budget of the MLB, you know something big is going to happen. The New York Yankees and the Chicago White Sox will play a game in Dyersville, Indiana, at the site of the Field of Dreams movie, to spread the good word of baseball, and play the first ever MLB game in the state of Iowa. But if you recall, the game in the movie wasn't quite MLB-sized, so the league will be building a temporary 8,000-person stadium right next to the original to fit the
the game. They have almost exactly 1 year to build since the Yankees and the White Sox will begin on August 13th, 2020. Pop culture, man, it's something else. And Groupon's ears must have been ringing yesterday after I talked about them, because they're thinking out of the box now. The discount marketplace just acquired a California-based text and voice communication startup, basically a virtual assistant that can help customers 24/7. But the question might stray towards, was this a money-saving investment so they can save a few bucks on their full-time employees? Or look towards the future? You know what they say, you gotta crack a few eggs to make an omelet. I'm Bennett Wakenight, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Thank you very much, Orion Samuelson. Steve Bertrand here on the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust Chicago's Bank. All right, the news earlier this week, the big ice raids in Mississippi, several different facilities there, and they rounded up, I believe it was about 680 people arrested. Many of them have been released, not that they've been cleared of anything. They'll go back for court hearings, but many have been released. Others, more than 300, are still being held. There is a local part to this story. One of the companies impacted is from Park Ridge, Cook Foods. In fact, Claire Bushy writes about that in Crain's Chicago Business, and she joins us now from the Crain's newsroom. Claire, welcome to the Biz Lunch.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You know, tell me first, give me a little primer on what happened with the raids and who was rounded up and about Cook Foods.
About 680 employees in Mississippi at chicken processing plants were rounded up by Immigration and Customs Enforcement. It was over seven plants with multiple employers, and one of them was Cook Foods, which, as you said, is Park Ridge and had $3.2 billion in revenue last year.
I should have known more about Cook Foods. It's a big company. I did not know that it was here or anything about it.
They're kind of a sleeper company. Like, you wouldn't be the only person to say that about them.
And what do they do? Is it just chicken, or they do all sorts of different food products?
They're a vertically integrated chicken processor. So they're sort of, they get them from the farmers, from the hatcheries, and then they are processed, which is a nice way of saying butchered, and then they are sold to restaurant chains, supermarkets, etc.
And the people,
very big player.
The people who were rounded up in Mississippi were what? They were butchering the chickens?
Yes, those would have been employees who worked in the plant in Morton, Mississippi. There's about 2,400 employees at the plant, according to the local paper in Mississippi, the Clarion Ledger.
Now, I know when this story with the press, you had asked for a comment from Cook and hadn't heard anything. Have you heard anything since?
I have not, no.
Right. And so when I read this story, or heard not this particular story, but the story about the raids, I'm thinking, well, what about these companies? If they're the ones who are employing these people, the people seem to be coming in doing an honest day's work for maybe not an honest day's pay. Are the companies going to suffer? We don't know yet if they're going to be prosecuted, but in your article, you argue that Cook is probably going to suffer for this.
It's certainly going to pay a financial penalty for business disruption, and that would, frankly, far eclipse any fines that they might have to pay to the government. They are going to have, they have a lot of half-processed chickens lying around the plant that have to be cleaned up to start with. Chickens come in every day, 1.3 million per week are processed at a large plant, which this is, and so if you have to change your business operations, you're going to be losing some revenue.
So that's the impression we're left with, right? That these chickens were half butchered or half taken apart when some of these people were taken into custody.
It was a daytime raid. The plant would have been running.
And so the Cook operation has to figure out what to do with these carcasses. Now, not everyone who worked in the plant was taken away, correct?
Correct. And the reports from yesterday were that the plant was partially running.
And do you know what these workers are paid?
Well, it is not a well-paying job.
Right.
It would be minimum wage or just above it.
And
their low unemployment situation has pushed up wages a little bit in the chicken processing industry.
But they're still very dirty jobs for very little money.
Well, as a labor leader in Chicago once said to me, gut snatcher is a real job title.
Right. And so now that these workers have been taken away, Cook is going to have to find presumably some legal workers to take their jobs in this job market that could be tough.
They're going to have to find someone to employ, yes. And in a low unemployment environment, that is going to be difficult. And they have received national attention. And so people might be nervous about going to work for them.
And so if they are to be punished legally, that comes down the road. But it looks as if certainly there has been a toll to pay before the legal remedies as these workers are taken away. You can read about it. Claire Bushy writes about it at ChicagoBusiness.com. Claire, it was great to talk to you. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.